Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, about this time 7 years ago, John Deere was arguing with a straight face that farmers shouldn't really own their tractors, because if they had access to the software involved, they could pirate Taylor Swift music. Things have changed since then, though industry still gets up and goes to court to say that even though you bought a tractor or a washing machine or a cell phone, it's not really yours in the sense that you can fix it if it breaks, even if you know how, even if you frankly can't afford to buy a new one. More and more people, including lawmakers, are thinking that is some anti-consumer and anti-environment nonsense. We'll get an update from Gay Gordon Byrne, executive director of the Repair Association. Also on the show, former president of Honduras convicted in U.S. of aiding drug traffickers, is the current headline. You'd never guess from today's reporting that Juan Orlando Hernandez was a U.S. ally, that the U.S. supported the 2009 coup that went a long way toward creating Honduras's current political landscape. We'll hear more from Suyapa Portillo-Villeda, advocate, organizer, and associate professor of Chicana Latina Transnational Studies at Pitzer College, as well as author of Roots of Resistance, a study of gender, race, and labor on the north coast of Honduras. That's coming up this week on Counterspin, brought to you by the Media Watch Group FAIR. The president of the Ohio Farmers Union wrote an op-ed, I saw it in the Dayton Daily News, lamenting that the needs and interests of family farmers have been ignored time after time by state and federal office holders. A key complaint, manufacturers' refusal to share the software needed to fix their products, forcing people to deal with a limited number of authorized shops or to just throw away the broken thing and buy a new one. Joe Logan wrote, quote, "Frustrating enough for ordinary consumers, for a farmer in the short window of harvest time, dealing with a breakdown of a $500,000 piece of equipment like a tractor or combine, it can be devastating," close quote. Farmers versus faceless corporations sounds like a ready-made storyline. So why don't we hear it? Why is the right to repair controversial? Gay Gordon Byrne is executive director of the Repair Association, online at repair.org. She joins us now by phone from upstate New York. Welcome to Counterspin, Gay Gordon Byrne.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Well, I think the right to repair is a keystone issue, affecting and reflecting a lot of other ideas, rights, and relationships. But first, we're talking with you now because the terrain is changing in terms of the law around people's ability to access the data and tools they need to fix instead of replace machines like tractors, like washing machines, and yes, like phones. The meaningful action seems to be at the state level. Can you bring us up to date on what's happening legislatively, statewide?
Sure. We've been working with state legislatures since January of 2014, so we now got a full 10 years under our belt. And over that time, I didn't get a completely accurate count because it does keep changing. Mm-hmm. We've actually been able to introduce bills in 48 out of 50 states, and over the years, that's coming up to about 270 plus pieces of legislation. So we're pretty mature now in terms of what we know needs to be done and can be done by states and what that wording looks like. So we're pretty experienced at this point. We've had some good success lately. We got our first couple of bills through to the end and signed by the governor starting in the end of 2022 in New York. Three more states, I think. I could be miscounting because my brain's a little fried.
Yes.
But three more states in 2023, and we've got a bill in front of the governor in Oregon. So things are looking good.
So when you go in at a state legislative level, what do you concretely ask for? What is that language in the bills that you put forward?
It's actually pretty much consistent. There's really only one active sentence, and it says that, hey, Mr. Manufacturer, if you want to do business in our state, you must provide all the same materials for purposes of repair that you've already created for your own repair services. That's pretty much it.
Right. So it means that you don't have to only go to the Apple store to fix your Apple tech, you know, but,
yep.
You know, that though leads me to another question, which I think you've worked on, which is some companies are kind of saying they support this, but there have important compromises involved in their compliance.
Yeah. Some compliance is flatly malicious. And we keep trying every time we, you know, file a new bill, we try to basically kick that malicious idea down and make sure that the bills as they go forward are more and more explicit and eliminate some of the loopholes that have been stuffed into bills, because legislators are really not necessarily technologists.
Right.
We don't expect them to be. But when a company like the Big Fruit Company says, hey, I want to support right to repair in California, they're kind of helpless. They'll take the support and they'll give away what they have to give away to get the bill done.
So what does that malicious compliance look like? It's a rhetorical support for the right to repair, but when it actually pans out, it doesn't look like what you're actually calling for.
Yeah, the best example right now is what we call parts pairing. That's been a problem all along, and we thought we had it nailed down in our template legislation, which we wrote back in 2015, that you can't require specifically that you buy a part only from the manufacturer and only new. And Apple got around it. They just said, well, we're going to make sure that if you order a part from us, it'll only work if you give us the serial number of your phone and we preload that serial number into the part that we ship you, and that'll work, but nothing else will, which is really malicious because it eliminates the ability to even use a part that might be brand new out of a phone that's busted.
Right.
And it eliminates the opportunity for a repair shop to stock any kind of inventory. It ruins the opportunity of restoring donated devices mm-hmm. so that they can be reused, because who's going to spend $300 to buy a brand new part when the phone is only worth $200?
Well, the right to fix things that we've bought and paid for, it shows up a kind of conflict between one narrative that Americans are told and tell ourselves about Americans as scrappy, as individuals who rely on themselves, and then this other different unspelled out story about how, no, you're stupid. You'll probably only hurt yourself. You know, the only responsible thing to do is to pay the company whatever they want to charge you. And you know what? Why don't you just buy the latest version? Wouldn't that be easier? You know, not everyone can or wants to fix their own stuff. But the idea that even though you bought it, you don't ever really own it, it just seems like it should be a hard sell, you know, to people. So how did we get here?
Companies have had basically a full generation, like 20 years, to perfect their marketing. And what they're marketing to us is exactly what you said, that we're too stupid to be able to fix our stuff. Concurrently with the stuff is too complicated to repair, mm-hmm. which is also baloney, because they create the repair materials that can be used by the least technologically expensive person to make repairs for them. I mean, we're not paying people, you know, $300 an hour to repair cell phones. They're getting paid $20, if that. So the tools that are there are made to make repairs easy and efficient and less costly for the manufacturer. But we've been told we can't do them. We've been told it's too sophisticated. It's too complicated. And, you know, the emperor really has no clothes. And the fun part about doing this legislation is seeing the eyes light up when we talk with legislators saying, you know, this is actually not right. It's not legal. There's supposed to be protections in antitrust law that prevent this behavior. But the Department of Justice has had about a 40 or 50 year kind of hiatus on antitrust. Mm-hmm. It's coming back, but it's very, very cumbersome to go that way. So the states have the ability to simply say, you can't sell this stuff on the one hand and then unsell it using an unfair and deceptive contract, which is typically an end user license agreement. Those agreements are of no value to anybody except to remove your rights to fix your stuff.
Right. And they're in the tiniest print you could ever imagine, you know. Mm-hmm. And I just finally, for anyone who's missing it, this isn't just a consumer rights failure, which is big enough, but it's also an environmental disaster to have industries based on buy it, throw it out, buy the new one. You know, that's just... that's a lose-lose.
It's pervasive. When we've taken a look at it and evaluated a lot of the contracts, we kind of come to the conclusion that something more than 90% of the equipment on the market today literally cannot be repaired by anybody other than the manufacturer, if it's repairable at all. And this is an environmental catastrophe. And it applies to everything that has a chip in it, which is now including toasters and blenders and coffee grinders and all sorts of little stuff that, you know, really, why do you have to throw it away?
Yeah.
First of all, it's made like garbage. But second of all, you can't fix it.
We've been speaking with Gay Gordon Byrne, executive director of the Repair Association. They're online at repair.org. Thank you so much, Gay Gordon Byrne, for speaking with us today on Counterspin.
Oh, my pleasure. Anytime.
The lead on AP's March 8th piece told the story. Former Honduran President Juan Orlando Hernandez was convicted in New York of charges that he conspired with drug traffickers and used his military and national police force to enable tons of cocaine to make it unhindered into the United States. U.S. Attorney Damian Williams said he hopes the conviction, quote, sends a message to all corrupt politicians who would consider a similar path. Choose differently, close quote. Heady stuff. The U.S. attorney added that Hernandez had every opportunity to be a force for good in his native Honduras. Instead, he chose to abuse his office and country for his own personal gain. Well, that sounds horrible. Not caring about the good of everyday Hondurans. Nowhere in AP's account is the role of the United States. Here presented as bravely bringing criminal Central Americans to justice for their efforts to pollute our country with their drugs. Nowhere is the role of the U.S. in shaping the political landscape in Honduras. So that's the storyline corporate news media are selling right now. But what is missing from that that might complicate it or deepen our understanding of current events? Suyapa Portillo-Vejeda is an advocate, organizer, and associate professor of Chicana Latina Transnational Studies at Pitzer College. She's also author of Roots of Resistance, a story of gender, race, and labor on the north coast of Honduras. She joins us now by phone. Welcome back to Counterspin, Suyapa Portillo-Vejeda.
Thank you for having me.
Well, first and foremost, I would ask you to please fill in some missing history for us in terms of U.S. involvement in Honduran elections and Hondurans' ability to choose their own political future. And you can go back as far as you want on that timeline.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad that you're raising and questioning corporate media because they don't really tell you the story, right, of U.S. involvement in Honduras. And, you know, I'm a historian, so whenever I teach about this, I go back 200 years, 300 years to the U.S. becoming the neocolonial power over Latin America after independence movements and being involved in Central America throughout the 20th century through warships, financial deals, through dollar diplomacy, the United Fruit Company. You know, we can go on and on and on. But I wanted to specifically with the Juan Orlando Hernandez case talk about sort of how the U.S. put him in office for two terms. We don't know what the inside machinations were, right? But we do have WikiLeaks that do tell us that the United States, the coup d'etat, was in cahoots with elite power in Honduras that replaced a democratically elected president, or actually kidnapped a democratically elected president. The U.S. Embassy was involved during President Obama and Hillary Clinton's tenure as Secretary of State, were involved in the kidnapping of the President of Honduras, Manuel Zelaya Rosales, putting him on a plane to Costa Rica in his pajamas. What's eerie about this whole scenario in 2009 is that the similar thing happened with President Ramon Villeda Morales, who was also a Liberal Party member in 1962, was also kidnapped in his pajamas and taken out of the country. So these are sort of U.S., you know, has its hands all over this kind of activity in Central America and all over the world, the developing world and the South. When this happened, President Obama denies the coup d'etat, denies it, and we spent, you know, academics, scholars all over Latin America as well as the United States spent a lot of time talking to press and anybody who would listen at U.S. Congress as well as news media outlets all over the world about why this was a coup d'etat. And it almost felt like we were in the twilight zone, but then later in 2011, we saw WikiLeaks cables that revealed that the U.S. Embassy was definitely in cahoots with the elite and the military in Honduras who wanted to oust Manuel Zelaya Rosales for his connections, quote-unquote, to Hugo Chavez in Venezuela at the time. And that coup d'etat changed everything in Honduras. And it spearheaded the decline of human rights and the decline in civil and political rights for people, for women and children specifically, right? It was extremely violent for women and children and has led to the 2017-2018 migrant caravans that people have been seeing on TV. The feminicides increased. We're looking at 700 women killed per year. We're looking at trans femicides. Also, you know, we're looking at 200, 300 women killed per year, trans women. So it's an incredible level of violence against young people who fight for the rights. What that does is then it opens a door for someone who would have never been elected as president, who had run two or three times before, and that's Pepe Lobo. And Pepe Lobo, who's also been linked to narco trafficking and the whole, you know, sort of apparatus, gets into power through sham elections, which the State Department supported and the U.S. Embassy supported, but over 68% of the Honduran population abstained because they felt, why should we vote if we had a democratically elected president? You know, why should we go to an election after this coup? What needs to happen is a reversal of the coup. And something really important gets born then. And, you know, some of the proponents were Mel Zelaya, Xiomara Castro Zelaya, Mel Zelaya's wife, who's now in power, but also Berta Cáceres, Miriam Miranda, leaders of the Afro-Indigenous and Indigenous movement, began to propose this notion of refounding the country. So while there was a lot of calamity happening, a lot of violence, there was also a resurgence in popular movement. The idea that you could have a different Honduras was also born in 2009 out of this calamity. When Juan Orlando Hernández was elected, it was contested election. I was in a fervor at the time, and it was the first time that Libertad and Refundación Party ran. The party itself was just kind of beginning to organize. The resistance movement had gone through a split. There were some people that wanted to continue the social movement aspects, and then there was another group that wanted to organize it into a political party, and there were fierce debates about this. And when you go to the polls, there was just a lot of corruption. It was very contested. And so Juan Orlando gets into power, the United States supports this sort of stabilizing force. They see the National Party as a stabilizing force. And one of the first things he does is he establishes the military police, which is something that had been eradicated with the peace accord post the wars in Central America in the early 90s. And the military police is this weird sort of police force that are military men with, you know, bayonets and war armament walking around the cities acting as police, right? So you have these multiple police entities in the city, but the military police is to be feared. These are the people that committed the disappearances. These are the people that engaged in violence against people in the 80s during the dark years, right, of fancy communism. Bringing them back was almost a suggestion of the U.S. Embassy, which then after came out and said, no, we never suggested this, but it was something that Juan Orlando Hernández did in cahoots with the U.S. Embassy. And in fact, the military police then comes back into power and begins to be the entity that harms most in the city. He also begins to collide and work with the elite, right, with the evangelical church, the churches, and an agenda that's extremely anti-women, anti-children, anti-LGBT, anti-human, really, right? Youth are the enemy of this administration. We just witnessed these extremely violent repression of young people, right? Many journalists were killed, over 200, I believe. People who defended territorial rights. Berta Cáceres, one of the brightest leaders in the resistance to Honduras. So I think at one point he issued 330 concessions on environmental land that had been, you know, hard-fought protected rivers and flora and fauna that were going to be stripped for mining. The one thing I want to say is during his election, the second time he was reelected, there was so many inconsistencies. You know, I've served as an election observer on all those elections, and the second time I brought students so we can cover a larger ground in San Pedro Sula, and it was clear from all of our observations, the winning parties, because, you know, you stay till the end, to the counting. And at one point, I had to shelter with my students in one of those locations because we had gone into like 1 a.m. during counting, and the military started throwing tear gas into the voting center, right? And there was a skirmish there between the military and who knows who, right? We were kind of sheltered in a room and with the counting. Like, we didn't want to leave the voting machines. I think about what an experience that was for my students, because when we think about protecting our rights in the United States and voting rights, we rarely see that level of violence inside a voting precinct, right? It's completely illegal. There was, you know, traffic in votes. There were all kinds of irregular things happening, like, you know, the Nationalist Party people were setting up offices within the voting precinct. You're not supposed to do that. Just outright mayhem. It was like the wild, wild west under Juan Orlando Hernández. It was the most extreme dictatorship that can only be compared to Carlos Sandino in the 30s. And people just wanted this man out because of the rampant violence, the abuse of power, and stealing from the coffers. I mean, at one point, $90 million stolen from the Social Security Administration, which is sort of like what workers pay into Pedro State Hospital. There were fake pills given to people who had cancer. There was no response to COVID except extreme lockdown, which people died because he instituted a curfew law, and anybody that was out after 10 o'clock could be shot or could be thrown in jail. And sometimes people were coming back from work or didn't have transportation. A young woman in Berta Cáceres' hometown died because she was arrested at 10 o'clock because she was out and then appeared dead the next day, right? Just the extreme violence that the police and the military all engaged with. Looking back as a historian, I think these were crimes against humanity. You know, this guy went down for engaging in drug trafficking, but really he needed to be tried for crimes against humanity, as do many other presidents, right, across the world. But what's a little scary about this ruling is people knew he was trafficking drugs, but you couldn't say anything because you would be dead. And so many, many journalists died trying to tell the story, but it was held down and shut. And in fact, many of the newspapers in Honduras cannot be trusted because they were, first of all, not telling the story of the protest. So if you go searching those newspapers, La Tribuna, El Heraldo, right, for these years, as a historian, I think there was this complicity between the elite, the rich, the landowners, those who wanted more land and more land, right? Taking it away from indigenous people and Juan Orlando, profiting from narco-trafficking, allowing narco-trafficking to happen, and the narco-traffickers to hurt people in the areas where they did, in the north coast of Honduras, the Garifuna territories, to go after leaders of those local environmentalists, protecting the environment, protecting the rivers, protecting the oceans from encroachment. You know, I wanted to say, like, yes, everybody knew Juan Orlando Hernández was a narco. You know?
Right. Mm-hmm.
But how do you challenge the Honduran people who are organizing? There needed to be more awareness from the U.S. Embassy. And I think the U.S. Embassy was complicit. And true, maybe the DEA built this case from the beginning and it took them many years. But they were also not in support of the resistance and the fact that he did not win that election in, you know, the second time. And that there was a blackout right at the end that lasted a couple of hours. And all of a sudden, 3 days later, he's president. The U.S. allowed for this man to lie to the Honduran people, to steal from the Honduran people, and to sit in that office, that is the highest office for Honduran, to sit while all these people were dying. And they committed this crime with him. They're complicit with it. The U.S. State Department is complicit with Juan Orlando Hernández. So when he's extradited, I think for Hondurans, it was a relief, right, to be rid of this pseudo-dictator narco-president. But there's a concern as well. There's something kind of malignant about that, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
That the U.S. becomes all-powerful and the decider of a country's fate. And that's scary.
We've been speaking with Suyapa Portillo-Vejeda of Pitzer College in California and also author of Roots of Resistance, a story of gender, race, and labor on the north coast of Honduras, where you can find much more information about what we're talking about today. Thank you so much, Suyapa Portillo-Vejeda, for speaking with us today on Counterspin.
Thank you for having me.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find shows and transcripts on our site, FAIR.org. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.